This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. This hour, we take a look at the experience of the soldier who's returning home from a war zone and compare it to his or her life as part of a platoon. A great many American servicemen and women suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. In fact, according to author and war journalist Sebastian Younger, the U.S. military is reporting the highest rate of PTSD in its history. American soldiers appear to suffer this twice as often as the British soldiers who were in combat with them. And, says Younger, despite billions spent on treatment, roughly half of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans have applied for permanent PTSD disability. Sebastian Younger's latest book is called Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging. And in it, he suggests that what awaits a soldier at home might be as much a part of the problem as the war experience. We'll talk about that and delve into the concept of tribe and the benefits of companionship, loyalty, and hardship as we welcome Sebastian Younger from the NPR studios in New York. Hello, Sebastian.
Hi there.
So I'd like to open with a quote from the book. And it goes, today's veterans often come home to find that although they're willing to die for their country, they're not sure how to live for it. It's hard to know how to live for a country that regularly tears itself apart along every possible ethnic and demographic boundary. To get us started, describe for us what a soldier experiences in a war zone as part of a platoon.
Well, obviously, you know, I'm not a soldier, but I spent a lot of time with American soldiers in Afghanistan in 07, 08. And what soldiers experience in combat is life in a group of 40, 50 people, sometimes less, sometimes 20, at remote outposts. They're sleeping together in the same place. They're eating meals together. They're doing everything together in an environment that could kill them and where they have to rely on one another and trust each other with their lives. That basically reproduces our, as humans, our evolutionary past. We evolved to live in communities of just about that size, mobile communities where everyone was interdependent, and there was no individual survival outside of group survival. That your personal interests and the group interests were overlapped so much that they were hard to distinguish.
And so this is essentially how you define tribe?
It's one of the ways, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the soldiers return home to prominently the vitriol that's hallmarked the 2016 presidential election. Describe what homecoming is like for many vets, Sebastian Younger.
Yeah, I mean, the current political situation is a kind of footnote in my book, and we definitely should talk about that. But we should also understand that going from that very intimate, interrelated, interreliant platoon experience back to the pleasures of modern society is extremely difficult, psychologically difficult. You'd think it would be easy. Easier life is easier back here. It's actually extremely hard. And that's true not only for soldiers, but for travelers, from the people who have traveled in the developing world and Peace Corps volunteers. Peace Corps volunteers who come home have quite a high rate of depression when they return. So Soldiers are not the exception. What happens to all of these people is that they're facing a transition from a community-based life to the kind of individualism that is exemplified by the great American suburb, by our modern society, and it's very hard on people.
Individualism, but also there's wealth, there's educational opportunities, so this doesn't help?
Well, I mean, oddly, it can almost hurt. I mean, as wealth goes up in a society, the suicide rate goes up. As wealth goes up in a society, the rate of depression goes up. Schizophrenia rises with urbanization. There are many blessings of modern society. I mean, I could list them almost endlessly. But there are downsides, and the downsides are, ironically, are psychological and emotional.
In your work as a journalist, have you been able to pinpoint the reason that there's a connection between wealth and comfort and, say, an increased rate of suicide?
Well, the experience of community, the interconnectedness of a tight-knit community, of a tribe, if we want to call it that, seems to buffer people against mental illness. And so One study that I saw compared depression rates in Nigeria, which is an extremely troubled and poor and chaotic and violent country, to depression rates in North America. And what the study found was that women in rural areas in both countries were significantly less depressed than women in urban areas. But that rural women in Nigeria, very poor demographic, but people who live communally, had way lower rates of depression than urban women in North America, the wealthiest group. So what happens is poverty and hardship force people to rely on each other. And even though there are stresses to poverty and hardship, of course, that that interreliance is so psychologically beneficial that it offsets the stresses and there's a net gain. When the Blitz happened in London during World War II, 30,000 Londoners were killed by German bombs, and the authorities were prepared for mass psychiatric casualties in addition to the physical casualties. And interestingly, the opposite happened. The admissions to psychiatric wards went down during the bombings. And, you know, as one official said, we have neurotics driving ambulances. During a crisis, it seems to be that people feel that their community needs them, and they step up, and maybe a way to put it is they forget their own troubles.
And so back to American servicemen and women who are returning home, there is a connection here then to, in your opinion, the high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder relative to militaries in other parts of the world.
Yes, and there's two issues here. I mean, when people are traumatized, almost 100% of people have a short-term reaction called PTSD, and it lasts some months or some weeks or months. It's completely adaptive. All mammals have this. You react to sudden noises. You sleep lightly. You have nightmares. All of these things prepare the human animal to deal with danger. And that dissipates after some weeks or months. Long-term chronic PTSD is a different matter. Only 20% of traumatized people seem to get stuck in a sort of long-term rut. Now let's look at the U.S. military. 10% of the U.S. military is engaged in combat. Mm-hmm. Only 10% are really in a position of being traumatized repeatedly during their deployment. But when people come home, when soldiers come home, around 50%, almost 50% of the U.S. military has applied for some form of PTSD disability.
This is outside the combat zone, you're saying?
Yeah, this is after the deployment, when they come back, when they get out of the service. So,
but people who haven't seen combat, you're saying? So 50% of the folks who are coming back?
Yes. So 10% of the military experiences combat. Almost half of the military applies for PTSD disability.
Okay.
So there's some percentage, 30, 40 in there, that really weren't traumatized, who feel when they come home that they have a significant psychological problem. So the question is, what is it that they're experiencing? They weren't traumatized. What is it that leads them to feel depressed and alienated and like they don't fit into this society? And what I what I argue in the book is that they're not having a transition problem. They're trying to transition to a society. There's no way to do this transition well because they're transitioning to a society which is inherently alienating and individualistic and is psychologically hard on everybody. The vets have had a year of very close communal existence with which to compare modern life to. And when they come back, the contrast is shocking to them. And if you talk to vets, they will say, you know, the hardest thing about coming back is that I just didn't fit into society. And I realized if you look at mental health rates in America and in modern society in general, you realize that a lot of people feel like they don't fit in. You don't have to have been in combat or on a deployment to feel like you don't fit in. That's an extremely common experience for civilians in general.
Sebastian Younger, as a journalist, as you mentioned, you've lived and worked in war zones. And also you have experienced PTSD yourself. Could you tell us that story?
Yeah, I mean, an awful lot of people have experienced PTSD. I mean, car accidents, spouses die of cancer. I mean, life's traumatic. And,
but
and
what was
anyone
the, oh, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to know what that experience was like for you, what happened to you.
Yeah. I was in Afghanistan in the fall of 2000. It was about a year before 9/11. I was with Ahmad Shah Massoud's forces of the Northern Alliance. They were fighting the Taliban, and the Taliban, you know, at that time had fighter planes and tanks and everything else. I mean, it was a real military. And we got hammered pretty hard a couple of times and saw some very hard things. And I got back to New York. And, of course, the nation wasn't at war, so I didn't really wasn't thinking about PTSD, like people weren't talking about it. And one day I went down into the subway station to go somewhere, and I had this incredible panic attack. And it was extraordinary because I knew intellectually I knew I was not in danger. But my entire being felt like I was about to be killed. The trains were going too fast. They were somehow going to jump the rails and kill me. The crowd of people on the platform was going to turn on me and beat me to death. I mean, the lights were too bright. Everything was too loud. It was an incredible feeling. Everything panicked me, and I literally ran out of there. And I kept having panic attacks for the next few months, and they gradually went away. And, you know, again, for 80% of people, those PTSD symptoms generally dissipate in some months after the trauma.
So just curious, did you seek some sort of treatment for the PTSD?
Well, I didn't know it was PTSD. I thought I was going crazy. And no, yeah. I didn't seek treatment. I just was puzzled and embarrassed and tried to avoid crowded small places, and eventually it went away.
We'll get back to PTSD among vets in a few minutes. But first, let's delve some more into the concept of tribe. The roots of this book extend 30 years back to your plans fresh out of college to hitchhike across the Northwest. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, after college, I wanted to see my country. And I got a backpack, a sleeping bag, and some camping gear, and bought some food, and hitchhiked across the country. And I wound up outside Gillette, Wyoming in late October. It was very cold, not a very friendly place. It's a pretty hard-bitten industrial town. And, you know, I was getting beer bottles thrown at me and stuff from pickup trucks, and I was pretty miserable. And I saw this figure walking towards me from town, coming up the on-ramp from town. And he didn't look good. He's a big guy, and he was in a sort of tattered union suit, and his hair was kind of matted, and he just was not looking good. And he came up to me, and I was a kid, you know, and I was very intimidated out in the West by myself. And he came up to me and said, "Hey, where are you going?" And I said, "California." And he said, "How much food do you got?" And I thought, in my sort of paranoid way, I thought, you know, I mean, I would give food to anyone who was hungry. But I thought he was just trying to get me to open up my bag. And I had a lot of, you know, I saved up my money and bought a lot of gear for this trip. And I thought I was going to get robbed. And I was like, I just got a little cheese. And he shook his head, and he was carrying a lunchbox. I forgot to mention he was carrying a lunchbox. And he said, you know, you can't get to California on just a little cheese. And he said, I live in a car in town. He was homeless. He said, I live in a broken down car in town. And every day I walk to the coal mine outside of town, which is, I think he said it was 3 miles, and to see if they need work, if someone's sick or something. And most days they don't need me, so I walk back. And they don't need me today, so I won't be needing this. And he extended the lunchbox towards me. He said, this is my lunch, but I won't be needing it today since I'm not working. And he insisted, and he gave me his lunch. It was a bologna sandwich and a bag of potato chips and an apple. And I just thought, you know, lots of people are generous, but not everyone takes responsibility for a stranger. And that's what tribe is.
All right. We're going to get back to this in just a moment on Radio Times. Our guest is journalist Sebastian Younger. His latest book is called Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. More in a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. We're having a conversation with journalist and documentary filmmaker Sebastian Younger. His latest book is called Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging. Younger has also written The Perfect Storm, and he's made a series of documentaries. The first, called Restrepo, was directed with his late friend Tim Hetherington. And again, we're taking calls at 888-477-9499, and email works as well, radiotimes at whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Sebastian, you know, of course, if we're talking about tribal life in this country, we tend to think of Native Americans. And I have to say, you don't use the term Native American, you use American Indian. Why is that?
Yeah, I was corrected by a man who's who's a member of the Apache tribe, Gregory Gomez. And I tried to say American Indian. I tried to say Native American. He said, you know, that just means someone who was born in North America. He said, I'm an American Indian. And So I was like, all right, we'll go for it.
Okay. Well, for the sake of consistency, we'll both use American Indian for this hour of Radio Times. You quote in your book, you quote Ben Franklin on the attraction of Indian life. Could you read what Franklin wrote to a friend a couple centuries ago for us?
Certainly. So this is from my book, Tribe, on page 2. Benjamin Franklin writing to a friend, "When an Indian child has been brought up among us, taught our language, and habituated to our customs," Benjamin Franklin wrote, "yet if he goes to see his relations and makes one Indian ramble with them, there is no persuading him ever to return. On the other hand," Franklin continued, "white captives who were liberated from the Indians were almost impossible to keep at home. Though ransomed by their friends and treated with all imaginable tenderness to prevail with them to stay among the English, yet in a short time they become disgusted with our manner of life and take the first good opportunity of escaping again into the woods."
So in this instance, what was it about the tribal way of life that was so appealing?
Well, thinkers and writers at the time, and I think I have to agree with them, theorized that what was appealing was the incredible personal liberty. I have a letter from a missionary who cited that, the incredible personal liberty of Indian society, of tribal society. It was an egalitarian society. There were concepts of personal liberty and egalitarianism that were taken from the Iroquois people and incorporated into the U.S. Constitution by men like Jefferson and Franklin and Thomas Paine. Indian society, tribal society, exhibited some of the ideals of the Enlightenment. They were just coming into the forefront in Europe at the time.
At the same time, wouldn't it be a mistake to completely romanticize the difficulties and even the brutality of Indian life in this country at times?
Well, it would be a mistake to romanticize the compassion of people in general. I mean, the European society was unbelievably brutal.
Sure.
The Spanish Inquisition, the kings and queens of Europe were incredibly brutal. ISIS has nothing over those people. And likewise, the American Indians, of course. They were constantly at war. They practiced torture. That was sort of the norm of the era in every society. But
fair enough, yeah.
But I think if you look at the sort of continual drip of refugees from the settlements off into the woods, into tribal society, and this wasn't just in early New England. This was continued for 200-300 years as the frontier marched across this country. There's a wonderful book called Empire of the Summer Moon that documents a young woman, a 16-year-old woman in Texas who was kidnapped by Indians and very quickly had the chance to be repatriated, and she refused, and she gave birth to a Comanche leader named Quanah Parker. Hmm. So there were accounts of captives, of the Indians, who just refused to go home throughout the centuries of our national history.
We've got emails coming in. Let's get to one from Peter, who asks, could you ask Sebastian Younger if he's drilled deeper on U.K. experience compared with U.S. experience? The reason I ask is that the U.K. troops in Afghanistan had some heavy casualties, all the worst of Taliban/IED combat, yet their country, if anything, was even less connected with the war, and likewise the EU. Can you parse that for us a little bit, Sebastian?
I found a statistic where of a study which found that American forces in Iraq and Afghanistan had roughly twice the rates of PTSD as UK forces that had very similar experiences in combat and probably similar experiences coming home. So I didn't go deeper than that study, and the authors of that study didn't really try to explain it, but it is interesting to note. I also just heard from a German friend of mine who read my book, and he said, you might like to know that after World War II, Germans referred to combat fatigue, as PTSD was known at the time. Germans referred to combat fatigue as the American disease. The German forces didn't really seem to get it.
And we've also got an email from Chip who says, this conversation reminds me of when pro athletes retire. They say they don't miss the game as much as they miss the locker room and their teammates. The athletes can't find this feeling of tribe in normal society and suffer depression as a result. You see the connection or a connection, Sebastian?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, the classic ancient definition of tribe is a community that you live with, that you share food and resources with, and that you would help defend with your life if need be. Does a professional football team or a sports team qualify? I mean, not almost. I mean, they're not necessarily living together, but they spend a huge amount of time together. I think the reason that these tribe-like structures are appealing in our society is because real tribal connection does not exist. And so when we get sort of watered down versions of it, even sports fans of a certain team that have no communal connection, they have an ideological connection. And even that we think about in sort of tribal terms because, frankly, I think we are all so desperate for that basic ancient human connection of community.
We're having a conversation with the journalist and documentary filmmaker Sebastian Younger. His latest book is called Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. You do write that, quote, whatever the technological advances of modern society, and they're nearly miraculous, the individualized lifestyles that those technologies spawn seem to be deeply brutalizing to the human spirit. Now, on the flip side, Sebastian, do you feel, is everyone cut out for tribal life? I mean, there are many who revel in solitude.
Well, we evolved for 2 million years to be a social species. And our survival was maximized by community. I mean, there really is no human survival in the wild on your own. We survive as a group. And as primates, we are absolutely social. There's one thing that happens in modern society, which is a complete aberration in our history, is that the sort of din and clamor of living with millions and millions of people and industrial machinery and traffic and everything else is that people withdraw into a shell because they're overstimulated and they become loners, they become recluses. But in the kind of community that that we were adapted for, that typifies human society for the last 2 million years, communities of 40, 50, 60 people, there's just no way to be a loner and to not relate to other people. Among other things, you depend on them for your life. I mean, you're just not going to eat. You're not going to survive without a rich connection with those people around you.
You've also written that so many, I guess, of us in this society speak of others with contempt and with a level of contempt usually reserved for enemies in wartime, except that now it's applied to our fellow citizens. So in your opinion, how has this harmed us as a people?
Well, the use of contempt in political discourse and derision, the accusation that someone is actually an enemy of the country, even though they're an American, saying that the president is illegitimate, that the government or the president is actually trying to harm their own country, that segments of the population, American citizens, somehow aren't quite as American, aren't quite as deserving of our great nation as others. Saying those kinds of things is deeply divisive in a way that no tribal community would ever permit, because it would literally threaten the existence of the tribe. And you just in sort of evolutionary terms, you might disagree with people, you might dislike them, you might hate them. But as one soldier told me out of Restrepo, you know, there's guys in the platoon who straight up hate each other, but we'd all die for each other. So what you don't do in a hostile environment, and every country in the world exists in a potentially hostile environment, what you don't do is use contempt and derision and try to disenfranchise people inside the wire. I mean, they're your people, and you may have to depend on them for your life. And so what you see in political discourse right now is this sort of bizarre fracturing of what we think America is, and that there somehow are Americans who aren't really fully Americans. And that is, in just evolutionary terms, it's a very maladaptive behavior. And I think it's, I mentioned ISIS before, the Islamic States in Syria and Iraq. They can hurt us. They have hurt European countries But they can't destroy our democracy. Only we can do that. And I think that kind of rhetoric is actually poses a real threat.
Okay. Let's get some calls in. Jelena in Wilmington is standing by. Jelena, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, this is Sandra calling from Wilmington. And I want to thank you so much for the really fascinating show you have on today.
Oh, thanks.
I'm interested in the show for many reasons. First off, I'm a sociologist, such a sociological study about tribal culture contrasted with individualism in our society. But also, I work with death row exonerees through an organization in Philadelphia called Witness to Innocence. And all of these men and a couple of women who I work with have symptoms of PTSD. I've attributed the symptoms of PTSD primarily to the brutality of the system and the effects of solitary confinement. But of course, I'm realizing another component to that is, believe it or not, these individuals who have sat on death row form a tribal sort of culture amongst their comrades who are facing state execution. And there's a level, what I've always called survivor's guilt, when they leave, even though the people who might be next to them on the row are guilty, they get to see another side of them. They've watched friends that they care for walk to their death through dead man walking type of scenarios going to be executed. And so I think the contrast, as your guest is mentioning, is particularly glaring for them. They can definitely relate to what these returning soldiers are going through because they come back to a society facing individualism and the stigma that's put on them even though they're exonerated. Sure. So I just wanted to share, I'm realizing another component of their PTSD has to do with the tribal culture behind bars.
Thank you, Jelena. Thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. Boy, she makes an interesting point. You can find tribe in so many places, Sebastian.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really poignant idea, the idea of tribe on death row. And I know from soldiers, and I've experienced it, the incredible guilt that comes when one of your brothers dies and you think, I should have saved him, it's my fault. And most devastatingly, it should have been me, not him, and I somehow abandoned him. And I had that when my colleague and friend and brother Tim Hetherington was killed in Libya. I was 6,000 miles away in New York, and I blamed myself.
You blamed yourself.
I blamed myself. And that's what happens is that in that sort of connection of brotherhood and tribalism and community, you take responsibility, like the guy did in Gillette, Wyoming, in a weird way. You take responsibility for others, and you almost would prefer that harm come to you than to them. It's akin to how many parents feel about their children. You know, let the bad thing happen to me, but just please, God, protect my children. And you feel that way about your peers. And so, you know, someone on death row being exonerated and leaving his brothers behind is you know, just heartbreaking. But I understand it. Humans are joiners. I mean, we're social species. We join groups to survive physically and psychologically. And if there aren't good things to join, people will create bad things to join, like street gangs. But join we will.
Let's get to another call. Derek, you're live on Radio Times. Hi, Derek.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question or your comment?
Well, it's fascinating. Sebastian, I don't know if you happen to be Catholic, but listening to the conversation, I started thinking about Catholic seminarians and how they're trained. And if you've seen any connection in your own research to some ill effects of being trained essentially like a monk for 7-8 years sometimes as you study for your graduate degrees and in preparation for the priesthood. And then, typically for diocesan priests at least, being elect your own devices, leading a very solitary life alone attached to a parish for the rest of your career.
Interesting.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Derek. I'm not sure if you've... you've delved into that line there, Sebastian, that story?
I haven't. I mean, to answer his initial question, I'm not Catholic. I'm atheist. I'm not religious. But I think there are components. There are sort of tribal components to religion. There's a strong sense of community and all that. This gentleman is talking about the opposite, the solitariness of a quest for communion with God, and that if the lone spiritual warrior goes off and does that, he or she can come back and help their community because precisely because they have isolated themselves and can hear God and communicate God. And that, I mean, that there are, I mean, in tribal societies, there are figures like that, right? There are shamans who are have one foot in the world of the divine and mm-hmm. the other foot in our world. And they're very special people. And that's a very special role. But it's not the experience of most humans. And I can imagine for a Catholic priest, it's extremely hard to do that. I'm sure it's hard for shamans as well.
Back to PTSD and service people for a moment. You say part of the problem is bureaucratic in this country, that 6 years ago, the Veterans Administration declared soldiers no longer have to cite any specific incident like a firefight or a roadside bomb in order to be eligible for disability compensation. How does this hurt soldiers?
Well, yeah, I mean, what I found out was that the you as you said, soldiers do not have to cite a specific incident. They can effectively self-diagnose PTSD. They don't have to offer supporting evidence. And the VA did this in order to speed up the backlog of cases because they were a very inefficient bureaucracy, as we all know, and they were trying to speed it up. And so what they did in trying to sort of help vets, and I'm sure they helped many vets get compensation more quickly. But in a weird way, I think they might have also done some harm, at least according to veterans I've talked to. They may have done some harm. Misdiagnosis, treating the wrong problem really doesn't help anybody, and it risks sort of over-pathologizing something. So if you have people who actually don't have PTSD, who weren't traumatized, what they're experiencing is difficulties with the transition back home. And if back home is a society that, frankly, a lot of people have psychological problems with or struggling psychologically in, if you insist on that somehow it's trauma related, but it actually isn't, it's a matter of our relationship to society, you're never going to find the solution. And what you don't want to do for anybody, for veterans, for people on work assistance, for anybody, what you don't want to do is create a sort of a whole class of people that are dependent on the government for their livelihood.
We'll talk
some dangerous and harmful.
I've got to stop you there because we're up against a break, but we'll talk some more about the VA in just a moment. Sebastian Younger is our guest. His new book is called Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging. And lines are open, 888-477-9499. If you'd like, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moscowane. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane, and our guest this hour is documentary filmmaker and author Sebastian Younger. His latest book is called Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging, and we're taking calls at 888-477-9499. And email works as well, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So just a moment or two more on the VA. Sebastian, I'm wondering if you've heard from veterans about coming home to find the scandal at the VA and whether this just adds to the stress that they're feeling.
Oh, of course. I mean, bureaucracy stresses all of us out, and veterans are having a particularly radical transition coming back from their platoon life, their possible experience in combat, to the society. So it does stress them out. But, there's a lot about modern life that stresses them out. I don't think it's just the VA, but it doesn't help.
All right. More telephone calls. Leanne in Princeton is standing by. Welcome to Radio Times, Leanne.
Great. Thank you so much, Mary.
Sure.
And Sebastian. I greatly look forward to reading your book here in the near future, Sebastian.
Thank you.
I'm a military spouse, and my husband has been active duty for 9 years, and he's completed 3 combat deployments. And I'm curious your thoughts on how kind of support system, be it spouses or parents, back at home can do a better job of supporting their spouses when they get back, or their kids, or whatever their relationship might be. I know for my husband and myself, we kind of have a unique situation since I've spent an extended period of time in India myself, so I've kind of had that homecoming and dislocation that you discussed earlier personally, so I can relate better to him. And he himself has joined a separate tribe when he's back home as a volunteer firefighter. So that's kind of how we personally have been able to kind of cope with these problems. And I'm curious if you have opinions on either bureaucratic solutions or just personal recommendations for those who do support service members themselves.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Liam. What do you think, Sebastian?
Hi. Well, yeah, thank you for the call. Well, I mean, family is vital to mental health and well-being, and you know, you can have all the community in the world, and if you have a dysfunctional family, it's very, very damaging. So if you have a strong family bonds, I think that helps enormously with veterans, with anybody. Family can't really take the place of community. I mean, and that's where modern society runs into trouble. The very strong family units, often in the context of a community where the families themselves are not very connected with one another. What happens in a crisis, of course, like in New York after 9/11, is the sudden hardships force the families together, and a community bond is formed. And then people find that is incredibly beneficial. After 9/11, the suicide rate went down in New York. The murder rate went down. Mm. Even Vietnam veterans with PTSD said that their symptoms improved after 9/11. So what you get is this societal coming together to face a crisis that feels good, right? And so for your husband coming home and transitioning to civilian life, I think he's doing joining the fire department is, yeah, it's absolutely a kind of tribe and fulfills all those sort of definitions of tribe. And I imagine he's very, very sustaining for him. I think he's doing the right thing.
So, Sebastian Younger, if I'm understanding you correctly, in your book, providing meaningful work is one of the best things you can do for veterans returning.
Yes, I think we all need meaningful work, and when people don't have that, they sort of psychologically they struggle a bit. After World War II, veterans came home, and the application rate for disability payment was very low compared to in today's wars. And you know, basically, the nation said to these guys, "Look, you fought the war, thank you, and now get to work. You know, here's a shovel, start digging. We need you back home now." And you know, I studied anthropology in college. I did my field work on the Navajo Reservation. And, you know, this whole book started with this idea. I was sort of thinking, I bet the Navajo warriors weren't getting PTSD, the Apache, the Comanche. You know, when they came back from combat, I bet they went right back into the hunting and gathering and rich communal life that was necessary for survival. And I bet that helped them. And I think there might have been a touch of that to the World War II vets coming back. When soldiers come back now, they came back to a very, very delicate economy, hard to get a job. And there was the offer of disability payments that, you know, frankly, it made sense for them to take those offers. But in the long run, some of that disability might actually, although it sustains them economically, might undermine them psychologically.
Sebastian Younger, I've read that some combat veterans actually volunteer to go back to Iraq to fight ISIS. That's hard for many of us to understand.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these guys volunteered in the first place to join the military because they wanted to experience combat, among other motivations. The guys that I was with out there, you know, these were the boys who played war when they were children, and then they turned 18, 19, and then they joined the Army and did the real thing. And so when you become adapted to that kind of environment and the intensity, even the intoxication of combat, it's extremely hard to give up. And I mean, one guy told me he was going to fight ISIS to treat his PTSD. And at that point, I was like, listen, man, you're going in circles. Like, I don't quite buy that one. Just tell me you like combat and you're good.
Yeah. You wrote in a New York Times article a few years back, "We avoid any direct look at the reality of war, and both sides of the political spectrum indulge in this. Liberals tend to be scandalized that war can be tremendously alluring to young men, and conservatives rarely acknowledge that war kills far more innocent people than guilty ones. Soldiers understand both of these things, but don't know how to talk about them when met with blank stares from friends and family back home." How do we bridge that divide?
Well, I think if the nation that sends people off to war, and I'm not pro-war, I'm not anti-war. I mean, war happens. Some of it, I think, needs to happen. So this isn't a political statement. But when we have a war, we the people are choosing the war. It's not the soldiers' war. We've hired them to pull the trigger. And when they come back, I think it would really help to give soldiers a forum for sharing with us what it felt like to do that job for us. And the idea that I had was that on every Veterans Day, you open up the town hall of every town and city in this country, and veterans have the right, veterans of any war have the right to stand up and talk in front of their community for 10 minutes and just talk about what the war felt like. You know, frankly, some people are going to be very, very proud, and they're going to say they miss the war, that they would wish they could go back, and liberals will get uncomfortable. And some people are going to be really angry, and they're going to spend the whole 10 minutes yelling. And some people will be crying too hard to even talk at all, and everyone will be uncomfortable. But that would allow the emotional experience of war, good and bad, to be shared by the entire community. And when people say, "I support the troops," a phrase that has absolutely no useful meaning at all, what that would now mean is that once a year you show up for an hour or two, whatever you can afford, to listen to the veterans of your community talk about what it felt like.
So thank you for your service. Well-meaning, but not necessarily, in your opinion, what vets want or need.
No, that's right. And we've tried this town hall idea already once with Representative Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, who was a Marine lieutenant in Iraq, fought very hard. And it was an incredible success. It was amazing. We had a 100-year-old vet from World War II, Korean War, Iraq, Afghanistan, amazing. There was a woman, an older woman, who stood up who said, "I fought in Vietnam as a guy, and I came home and had a sex change." Extraordinary, extraordinary stories.
Sure.
And really cathartic. And if you go to my website, sebastianyounger.com, there's a page devoted to veteran town halls. They cost nothing. They're easy to do. And I'm really hoping that this might provide some forum for connection between soldiers and the civilian world.
Well, Sebastian Younger, we've got a full bank of calls. So Anila in West Philly, you are next. You are live on Radio Times. And
hi, welcome. Thanks so much for taking my call. I really appreciate the fact that you brought up the Peace Corps as well. I'm a returned Peace Corps volunteer from Zambia. A couple of years, I've been home for 3 years, and my brother has been in the U.S. Marine Corps for 6. So we went in right about the same time, and so have very different attitudes towards service, but it is all still service. And I wanted to say thank you, but then also I know when you were just talking about the town halls, the most important way that I transitioned back to the U.S. was that sense of community with other returned Peace Corps volunteers. So we have monthly happy hours in Philadelphia, and getting together with those other returned Peace Corps volunteers, whether they had gone in the 1960s when the program first started, or had just gotten back, or were just going, that was really us being able to talk with one another, share free of judgment with one another about our experiences, about our communities. What we had gone through was the most important way that I transitioned back, a supportive family. So my brother is just recently deployed, so I think the veteran town hall idea is definitely something that I will absolutely go on your website and try and organize.
Sure.
For here in Philadelphia.
Anila, let me just ask one question. What was your greatest challenge in transitioning back to the United States? Do you mind me asking?
Absolutely. I think the glazed over eye that many people give, and knowing from my brother's experience being in the military and then my own, wanting to talk about it because it is such a positive, at least for the Peace Corps, it is such an incredible experience. It's so intense. You learn so many things about a different culture, a different language, a different place, and then about yourself. But you have about 30 seconds with most people before they kind of stop listening.
And that's the farm.
Maybe they can't necessarily empathize, and it's a little bit easier to just go, "Oh, well, how was it?"
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
It was an incredible experience. And that was kind of my flatline answer for many people. So you, with the military, with the Peace Corps, with a lot of these national service programs, AmeriCorps is another one. They're very intense experiences, but I think one of the biggest things to kind of cut down on a lot of the stigma or the miseducation or misrepresentation of all of these different service programs is to try and educate and have those community forums. But
yes.
It's
Anil, I'm going to have to just, I'm sorry, you have some really important information, and you've just said some really interesting, some real interesting insight about what it's like to come back. And I think, Sebastian, again, the idea of the forum gives the tribe, if you will, a chance to really talk about the experience. And if there's any healing to happen, it can begin there.
Yeah, I mean, notice, and it's great, but notice that she is forming a community of her fellow Peace Corps volunteers. Mm-hmm. What's not happening is that those experiences are coming back to the wider community. They're forced to have a subset of themselves because there isn't a wider community to relate to. And what the town hall idea would do is actually take that subset of soldiers and inject their raw personal experience, good and bad, into the entire community. And that's what that would amount to, a sort of tribal situation. It would make even towns in modern America have a moment of sort of tribalness that I think would be really beneficial.
Anila, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. We've got time for one more call. Michael in Westchester, we only have a moment or so, but welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you so much. First of all, Mr. Younger, huge honor and opportunity to talk to you. Your film, The Last Patrol, changed my life. I was a military advisor to the Iraqi Army in 2006 in Diwaniya. Didn't get a lot of press, but I was there during Operation Wilderness. And I was wondering if you have anything prescriptive for guys like me. Like, I was part of that 10%. I was the last vehicle in the exfil from the city when that whole operation went down. And I'm, you know, I've struggled ever since then. And, you know, I've been to the VA. I've seen the guys you're talking about that are misdiagnosed, and it's just a frustration when they share in groups and stuff like that. And I mean, what would you recommend?
Well, let me just get this in quickly. I would love to meet you. It's, your experiences sound amazing. And I'm actually on Monday at 1 p.m. I'm going to be in Philly at the American Legion Post number 10 in Fort Washington. So if you're free on Monday, come down, and I'd love to shake your hand and we can talk more. But, you know, some problems are not entirely solvable. I think it's a tall, tall order to take the intensity of combat and expect people to gracefully, easily transition to a modern society that, you know, was frankly, in historical terms and evolutionary terms, pretty weird. You know, I mean, we humans have never lived like this before. But I think what we can do, I think the solution for vets is societal. I think the society has to heal itself, and it has to heal itself because all of us are struggling a bit in it. And if we do heal ourselves, veterans are going to be fine. I mean, they'll go off and have these experiences, and they'll come back to a more interconnected society where their experience overseas makes more intense sense. And that ultimately, long term, I think, is the solution.
And thank you so much for the call to Radio Times, Michael. Sebastian Younger, a quick note. We've got an email from WM who says the only solution to any of the issues being discussed is to reinstate the draft so a cross-section of the population experiences U.S. government's actions of war. What's your take on that?
Well, okay, maybe, but then how do you create community when there's no war? I mean, the draft only applies during wartime. I mean, if they're talking about national service with a military option, that's an interesting idea. So, you know, every generation of 18, 19-year-olds is made to understand that they owe a couple of years of good service to their country. Some people will want to carry a gun, be okay with that. Some people will be handed a shovel and told, start digging. We need to build this country. And that would be I think that would be enormously beneficial.
So quickly, Sebastian Younger, I've read this is your last book you'll write on war. What's next for you?
I don't know, actually. I wish I thought that far ahead. My life would be different if I could.
Well, Sebastian Younger, it was a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sebastian Younger's newest book is Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging. And as always, we invite you to visit our Facebook page. And you can take a look by heading to whyy.org/Radio Times. You'll find our podcasts there as well. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times.